Roar. Good, says Duke. The door bangs open behind us, and he releases me like a spring. I pitch forward into the bed, just saving myself from landing atop poor Mama's belly, while the nurse, reeking of rye whiskey, makes some anxious, disjointed apology about visiting the lavatory. 12. Sometime in the night, Mama wakes up lucid. I'm dozing beside her in the bed, and I bolt straight up. Mama! Geneva Rose? That you? It surely is, Mama. Thought I done hurt you there somewheres. You surely did. Right here next to you on the bed, Mama. That's right good of you, sugar. So pleased you came. Course I came. You're my mama, aren't you? She doesn't answer. She's been whispering, like the sound of paper moving against paper. And I can't see her real well in the dark like this, only the coals for light. I reach out and find her hand, and for some reason, I am overcome by the memory of those hands braiding my hair when I was small, before she sent me away to the convent. I used to stare at her lively fingers in the scrap of mirror above the washstand, darting in and out of my uncooperative copper mane, whipping those strands into nice, neat, overlapping order on either side of my head, mouth full of pins. She used to tell me how she did the other girl's hair back in New York. She was real good at it. You was reading Little Women, wasn't you? Your favorite. Remember how we used to read together, Mama? You had all the voices just right. You was always such a good reader, Geneva Rose. You read still, when I can. You all right in New York? You ain't got yourself into no trouble, have you? Never once. I take good care of myself. Knowed you would. That's why. Voice lapses away. Why what, Mama? Why, you let me leave for the city? Yes. Had to, didn't I? I run my fingertips along the bones of her hand. I reckon so. My pulse is striking wildly. My lips are dry. I do recall reading that the dying sometimes discover a moment of final clarity just before the reaper bends down and snatches them away. Feel as if my eyes are scraping the shadows, looking for a sickle gleaming in the moonshine. Feel as if the seconds are ticking away. No way to ask what she needs asking. No way to say what needs saying. And she's gone quiet. Maybe it's over already. I press her knuckles. So sorry, she whispers. Relief. You got nothing to be sorry for. Did all you could. You're a good mama. She says something I can't quite make out, something that sounds like negation. Why, yes you did, Mama. You found a way to send me away to the convent, to college.
No!
This word, unlike the others, comes out by force, sort of a strangled little shout. I lie there on my side, facing her, smelling her medicine's sick sweet smell, the damp heat of her nightgown holding her hand. Realizing that the smell of medicine is really the smell of alcohol, only more pure. I touch her hair, which is softer than I guess I was expecting, thin and fine next to her head, like somebody's been brushing it all day. Her head is moving a little from side to side. Now, Mama, you just rest.
That was your daddy. Your poor dear daddy.
I place my hand on her opposite cheek and turn her face an inch or two in my direction.
Mama? You mean Duke? That was Duke's idea, my education. He did love you so.
Oh, Mama, I don't know about that.
Duke, your daddy,
she insists, fervid emphasis, and I realize in the darkness. Her eyes are wide open, and she's staring at me like you might stare at an apparition of some kind. A vision from another universe. My daddy. I repeat. The eyes close.
Loves you so?
Now, I've never given much thought to the man who sired me. I guess that might surprise you. All the Fifth Avenue psychologists say that I ought to have some kind of complex about my real daddy, some kind of fixation, most especially since the fellow who took his place turned out so rotten. Well, that might be true for some girls, but not for me. I don't spare him a single consideration most days. Why should I? I don't reckon he spares one for me. And just look what he did to my mama, leaving her to die away like this. Suck inside her poor old broken-down childbearing body. And as much as I mind him at all, I figure he's some Manhattan swell who spotted my mama and thought he might have himself a good time with a pretty girl from the Review, and so he did. So I can't quite explain why that tender whisper, "loves you so," causes such a bubble to swell up in my chest, squeeze out all else, breath and heart and everything. "You mean my real daddy, Mama? That who you mean?" She's moving her lips, but the words aren't coming forth. And I give her hand a squeeze, kind of sharp, to bring her back to River Junction. Her eyelids make this spasm. She says, "Lauren." Except it all runs together. "Lauren." "Who's Lauren?" "Lauren." I pick my thoughts a bit, stroking her head. "You mean Laura Ann Green, Mama?" "Lauren," she says once more, nodding. And she closes her eyes again, black in rapture, and goes all still. Just her lips moving and moving without making a sound. And there's nothing I can do to rouse her. Though I do realize sometime later that her fever is gone. Skin as cool and dry as yesterday's washing. 13. Mama's dead by morning. The nurse and I wash her frail body and lay her out on the bed in what Johnny says is her favorite dress, though I don't recognize it. Course not. I guess it must be one of the new ones Duke bought her. Velvet the color of midnight, fashioned that from before the war. Her skin is terribly pale against that dress. Soon after comes the undertaker, neat and respectful in his black suit. He and his assistant load my mama into the van, and the assistant drives the van away while the undertaker disappears with Duke into some kind of private study on the first floor. By now it's gone 10 o'clock. Too late to go back to bed and get some sleep, even if I could, though I haven't slept more than 3 or 4 hours in the past 48. Can't even imagine the act of closing my eyes. Too many thoughts jumping around behind them. I wander around the first floor, heels clickety-clack on the fields of pale marble, looking for the kitchen and a possible pot of good black coffee. Figure it's gotta be around here somewhere. Round the back, out of sight, a rich man's kitchen. I pass through the door at the corner of the dining room and down a long corridor of a butler's pantry, and there it lies, good glory, a kitchen about the size of the entire first floor of the old house, inhabited by a cook and a kitchen maid, cleaning up the breakfast dishes. The maid wipes her apron and fetches me toast and coffee. Her face is familiar. I expect I went to school with her, too. In that time, I try generally not to remember about. Before they sent me off to the nuns. I stand about awkwardly, thinking of something to say to the cook, who stares at me under her eyebrows like I'm some kind of exotic new fruit she's fixing to chop up and serve at luncheon. Duke Kelly's missing daughter, turned up on the eve of her mama's passing on. You don't see that kind of thing walking through your kitchen door every day. So I stand there, staring at the ceiling, arms crossed behind my back. Cook sets to work. Toast arrives crisp and buttery, coffee hot and thick. Maid says softly, "I'm awful sorry about your mama, Geneva Rose." And I put my face into grievous position, the kind of expression I guess you're supposed to return to a statement like that. And I thank her for her sympathy. Still can't remember her damn name. Since I am so patently in the way, here inside this brand-new kitchen of Duke's, staffed by staff, brand-new garland range, brand-new icebox, pantry the size of Pennsylvania Station. I pour myself a little more coffee and wander back upstairs to Mama's room. The door to the study is still shut tight. Nobody's stirring. The house has got that heavy, unsettling quiet lying atop the floors and the furniture, like you don't even dare to whisper. My mama's dead. My mama's gone. Just a room left behind, her relics. What used to be Mama. Still, I climb back up those stairs, bearing my coffee cup in its saucer, looking for her. As if, when I push open that heavy carved door, she's going to be lying there again, containing some scrap of life left, some bit of blessed spirit on this earth. Bedroom's empty. Maids haven't started the cleaning yet. Counterpane a little rumpled, betraying a wee hollow where her body lay before the undertaker, and his stone-faced assistant loaded her up and carried her off. I set down the coffee and crawl in, curl myself into the hollow of Mama's body. Smells like medicine and sweat, and I guess I will smell that particular combination all my life now. All my life I will carry that scent in my head, and it will bring this moment back to me. This void. This terrifying absence of my mama from this earth. This air on my skin, where her soft arm should rest, holding me safe from harm. 14. And then a funny thing happens. I don't know if you believe in ghosts. I sure enough don't. I believe in what I can see and touch, what exists. Why, there's times I can't say for certain I believe in God himself. He does have a habit of making himself scarce around here. Anyway, I'm lying in my mama's bed, in the cool hollow of the counterpane formed by what was my mama's living body a short time ago, and I imagine I hear my mama's voice, not inside my head where it regularly belongs, but outside, from no particular direction, just there. Clear words. Laura Ann. I open my eyes. Nothing there. Just the furniture, French, topped in marble, one louis or another, gilded an inch or so thick and bought at great expense, I reckon, from some dealer in Baltimore or Philadelphia, bearing no attachment whatsoever to my mama's past or mine. Still, I sit up, swing my legs to the floor. I am unwashed, wearing yesterday's dress, could not yet bother myself to open my wee satchel and freshen up. I catch my reflection in the opposite mirror, the one stuck above the drawer chest, except that it isn't my reflection at all. It's my mama's. Mama's gentle face inside a frame of my own bobbed ginger hair, except younger somehow, the way she looks in her wedding photograph. Smooth dairy skin and playful hooded eyes, lips parted a half inch, gazing right directly at me. Geneva Rose Kelly. Like she's got something stuck inside her she wants to let out. "What is it, Mama?" I ask her, even though I don't believe in ghosts. I guess my eyesight returns to normal just then, or maybe I've blinked, because it's just my own ordinary face in the mirror now. Not beautiful at all, only sort of striking. The kind of face that photographs well, almost downright ugly since I haven't slept in so long. White face and slanted blue eyes, large sharp nose and full mouth, and chin descending to a point like a witch's hat. Not my mama at all. Still, I rise to my feet and walk across the room to that damn mirror above the gilded drawer chest, and I reach out my hand and touch the surface, as if that might summon her back. Summon back the illusion of her. But my fingers meet only the cold, smooth surface of my own image, just below the scarred right eye. And though I wait and wait, I don't hear anything more, nor does the face in the mirror change to anything more agreeable or straightforward than my own imperfect mug. I let my hand fall. Right down next to the small ormolu clock, ticking under the exact center of the mirror, and the square enamel box before it. and my gaze drops too, right down there to where my hand rests. And naturally, my curiosity and my despair sort of direct themselves into the smooth, expansive surface of that box. Not one she had before, that's for certain. Not trimmed and hinged and fastened in gold. I expect Duke must have given her that box to keep all her, what, trinkets? Mama never did have any trinkets. None that didn't get pawned at one juncture or another. I stand there for some time, staring at that pretty box. Had my long, slender hand rested next to one corner. I don't go in for lacquer. Just you try keeping your nail lacquer shiny while your fingers go tappity-tap on a typewriter all the livelong day. And besides, they don't allow nail lacquer at Sterling Bates, heavens no. But I take nice care of the nails anyway. File them regular, rub my cuticles with cream. A fine-looking hand, by any standard. And I swear, that hand does not move. Does not so much as twitch one single fingertip. But the lid of that enamel box does slowly rise into the air. 15. On the other hand, I am so damn tired. You recollect, perhaps, that I have not slept 4 hours in the past 48, so I might well be dreaming. Or I might be observing the sequence of strange events as a kind of mirage, the way desert travelers imagine things that aren't there, things they desire to see, things for which they thirst and long and crave like water, like shelter, like the green shade of a date palm. So I stand there and listen to the tick of that ormolu clock, nice and steady, though my heartbeat strikes about twice for every second. I stand there staring at that enamel lid, gaping wide like the mouth of an alligator. Box is about 8 inches square. Delicate gilt motif of an oriental type, painted in small precise repeats, and you would not believe the intricate gold trim along the edges. Simply could not have been wrought by human hands, however so nimble. There is not enough light that I can see what lies inside. Not a glimmer, or a shadow, or a hint. So I stand there, ears peeled, concentration absolute, waiting for some kind of instruction, I guess, that never does arrive. Tick-tock. My pulse settles. I move my finger.
Now then, I just thought I might find you here, Geneva Rose, picking through the loot.
I expect the jump of my nerves does me no credit. You get out of this room, Duke Kelly. You got no business here. He just laughs, free as you please, wearing a black morning suit, black tie, collar all wide and stiff against his bull neck. He steps forward and settles himself in the armchair before the fireplace. The fire's gone out. Nobody's come to lay more coal, and crosses one leg over the other. Nods to the drawer chest and my guilty body, shielded in the open box, to my arms folded over my drumming heart, tells me,
"You can take that if you want. Take whatever you damn please."
"I'm not taking anything from here."
"You sure about that? There's a fortune laying here in this room with us. Jewelry inside the safe right there. Clothes from Paris. I know you like pretty clothes, Geneva Rose. Pretty things."
"I don't want your things." Shrugs.
"As you like, sugar. You change your mind, it's all right here waiting for you. Not going nowhere."
"You set a date for the funeral?"
"Friday noon. You fixin' to stay?"
"Course I am. She's my mama."
"You be needin' a room to sleep in."
All of a sudden I wish I had a cigarette. Something for my fingers and mouth to do. I uncross my arms, brace my hands against the drawer chest behind me. "I can stay with a friend."
"Friend, Geneva Rose? What friend? You ain't got no more friends in River Junction. Nobody's seen you in years."
"Ruth Mary Leary would have me."
Duke smiles and reaches inside his jacket. "Now, baby girl, ain't no need for that kind of thing. Ruth Mary's got 4 wee babies of her own. She ain't got the room for you. And folks'll talk, won't they? You don't want folks a-talking, do you?"
"I guess they've been talking plenty already. Don't make a difference if they talk some more. Anyway, I don't give a damn if they talk or not. I gave that up long ago. I don't give 2 cents what folks here think about me. He takes a long first drag of his cigarette, and when he takes his mouth away and blows out a pleasurable big gust of smoke, he tells me I'm a damn fool. I'd be a damn fool to stay under your roof another night.
Now, there you go again, Geneva Rose, thinking I desire any more peace of you, when you've been spreading those pretty legs of yours all across New York City the past 4 years.
So you say. When did I ever trust a word from your mouth? He shakes his head slowly and pops a little more smoke from his gasper. Considering the ceiling 12 feet high.
I ain't never broken my solemn word, Geneva Rose, and that's the truth. You can rest easy under my roof. That ain't what I want from you no more, how grown up as you are.
I don't care what you want from me. You're not getting it. I am leaving River Junction for good, the second my mama's grave is covered over. You won't be seeing me around here again, not ever. You won't be hearing from me. Not a single word, do you hear me? I'm done with you.
What about your brothers and your sister? You done with them, too?
They know where to find me.
Your baby sister don't. She is but 5 years old. Why, she won't even know you by the time she's grown.
My stepfather leans back in the armchair now, black on crimson. Smokes all comfortable. Says quietly, still gazing at the ceiling.
Fixin' to be a beauty, your sister, ain't she? An almighty beauty.
What a throat he's got. Tendons all stuck out, thick and round and pink as a watermelon. Adam's apple does this jig up and down as he swallows back spit. From his hand trails the cigarette, which I crave right now as I crave water to drink, air to breathe, bed to sleep in. But I don't say so. Would rather skin myself.
I just shrug and say, I guess she is, hard to tell at her age.
But she sure does dote on Johnny, and he worships her right back. Wouldn't let a fly touch a strand of her hair, I'll bet. I bet he'd kill the fellow who touched her, sure enough. Cut that fellow's throat and leave him for dead. Leave him to choke on his own blood. Duke closes his eyes and smiles at the ceiling. The silk-hung ceiling as crimson as hell.
"Geneva Rose," he says. "I do sometimes feel that the two of us might have got off on the wrong foot together."
"No such thing as together with you and me, Duke Kelly. No such thing."
"Baby girl, you just settle your sweet self down. You ain't thinking clear." "I'm talking about business."
Chin lowers at last, eyes open to meet mine.
"Business, that's all."
"Business? You and me?"
"That's what I said."
My palms are sweating against the edge of the drawer chest. Head's got that sick feeling, like I might pass out. Feel some kind of weight pressing right between my shoulder blades. A kind of poking and prodding, something trying to make itself known. I stick out my chin and say, "I've got no interest in your line of business."
"Now, that is plain unkind of you, Geneva Rose. You ain't even heard me out."
"I don't need to hear you out. You're a damn bootlegger is what you are. And I may trickle a little refreshment down my throat from time to time, but I don't like to think about how it got in my hand. And I especially don't like to think about the men like you who put it there. You can keep your business to yourself. I don't want any part of it. Any part of you." I say this all impassioned, sort of a fury. And Duke, my stepfather, my dead mama's husband, the daddy of my brothers and my sister, he just sets his elbow on the arm of that chair and curls his meat hand into a fist and leans his cheek into the knuckles of that fist. He doesn't blink, doesn't twitch. Curtains be shut tight out of respect, only an electric lamp burning by the side of the bed. And his skin's all smooth and dusky, and his eyes are empty. He is like a man someone carved out of wax.
"You believe you're too good for me, Geneva Rose? Too good for this family and this town, that it? because myself, I do happen to believe that we are all God's creature, Sugar. All of us here created in His precious image. And there ain't one of us no better than the other. And the people of this town, they is mighty grateful for this business you don't want no part of. Mighty grateful. They ain't starving, and they ain't falling sick like they did. You want these good people to starve, Geneva Rose? You want them to die of the ague and the pneumonia and the bearing of children? You mean like Mama did? Well, he does flinch at that. A little bit of pink seems to stain his cheeks, if I'm not mistaken, in this somber-lit room. Sweetheart, your poor Mama never was strong. Ain't nothing we could have did for her, except to make her comfortable. Done all we could for her until the good Lord seen fit to gather her back into His loving arms. Now the hair's prickling on the nape of my neck, and the skin of my arms. Now the electricity tingles my scalp, damp and nervy. Air seems fit to burst all around us, like some kind of fireworks contained in the atoms and molecules striking against me. The angry pressure between the blades of my shoulders just squeezes away my breath. I'm afraid to turn my head back to that mirror, back to that open enamel box. I move my hand a little, thinking I might shut the lid again, push all this mad energy back in its place. And you know how it feels when a bee stings you out of nowhere? Well, a bee stings me right out of nowhere, right on the back of my hand. "Something the matter, baby girl?" asked Duke. "Nothing's the matter." "You need to sit down?" "No, I don't need to sit down. I need some peace and quiet, that's all. I am mourning my mama." Duke regards me a minute. He lifts his head from his knuckles and rises from his chair. "That's true." "Haven't slept in days."
"Ain't you? Then I reckon you best get some rest."
"I best?"
"But you think about what I said, all right? You just think on it. I ain't a-talkin' about no heavy work. I ain't a-talkin' about carryin' in moonshine up the Lincoln Highway and that kind of thing. I got plenty of men for that, Geneva Rose, plenty of men for that kind of work. Just require you to deliver a package or two from time to time to some gentleman I know in the city, that's all. You and your pretty face, you can do that easy as winkin'. And I'd pay you good."
"You could pay me the moon, Duke Kelly, and I wouldn't take it."
"I ain't a-talkin' about the moon. Who needs a dang moon? I mean real money. Money you can buy things with."
He takes a few steps toward me, so I can smell his teeth and his hair oil and his cigarette burning from his left hand. See the ripple of his skin as he talks. $100 a time, Geneva Rose. Give up that job of yours a-tapping all day long. Give up them dirty photographs you do. So you just think on it.
You think on it and let me know."
Can't breathe. Can't think. Heart's racing like a thoroughbred. I gasp out something or other. Tell him I will surely think on it and let him know. He takes his hand and places it on my cheek, covering my bones, covering my ear and my jaw, and he leans close and kisses my hot electric forehead.
"Now, I just knowed you'd come around, Geneva Rose, just like the good, sweet daughter you always been."
16. 3.5 years have passed since I ran away from Duke Kelly into the hot blue morning toward the fishing hole, not thinking straight, and I reckon I've been trying to atone for my folly ever since, to cleanse my skin of the stain of his touch. The good, sweet daughter you always been. My God, I want to scrub myself raw, peel myself bloody all over again. I don't remember what happened all that well, you understand. There are times I think, Lord Almighty, I must have dreamt it. The memory has that quality of dreams, all impression and emotion, such that you only really recall an instant or two. A sharp encounter. And you have to piece everything else together, and that's when you realize the whole thing doesn't make any sense. That maybe you imagined it after all.
I do recall running from that hen house, skin burning from the slice of chicken wire. I recall that I reached the creek and fell down on my knees and washed my face and hands and neck in the cool, clear water, disturbed the long-legged bugs that skated on the surface, smelt the good smell of mud and creek rot. My heart banged against my eardrums. My breath hurt my throat. I recall that I crawled all the way into the water, hands and legs sinking in the silt until I was almost submerged, until I began to float in the lazy, wide pool where the creek spread itself out under the shade, until I felt a pair of cold eyes on my skin and I turned, arms flailing, to find Duke sitting on a boulder near the water's edge, lighting himself a cigarette. Now, Duke can't swim, any more than he can read the words in a book. Least I never saw him inside of the water that I can recollect. But you wouldn't have known this fact to look at him right then, no, sir. He just sat there on that boulder, smoking his cigarette, staring at me while I shivered and paddled in that pool of creek water, keeping myself afloat, considering my options. Or so I must have done, because I don't remember that part. Just him staring and the smell of his cigarette, and the way I felt like a naked she-rabbit trapped in a snare. Couldn't swim downstream on account of the footbridge. Couldn't swim upstream on account of the springhouse sitting right there atop the narrowing of the creek bed. Water was mountain-fed and already my skin was turning numb, my brain icing over. I recall that very well, how my head hurt with cold. And then I must have made my choice because I remember darting for the opposite bank, swimming as fast as ever I could. But I could not swim faster than Duke crossed that bridge, because as soon as I lurched ashore, dripping and gasping, he did take me by the shoulders and pull me into the tall summer grass, pinned me down with his knees while he fixed our clothes. I don't remember how. Don't remember whether he first yanked up my skirt or undid his trousers, whether he ripped my blouse open or whether it was already loose. I recall his paws on my breasts, the purple side of his organ bursting free from all that nest of black hair, some kind of pain on my thighs, where he held me down somehow. White panic laying down on my brain, my arms and legs too stunned to move, just my fingers twitching and twitching while he spread me apart, and then the sharp edge of a rock meeting the tips of the fingers of my left hand, like the Lord God saying in my ear, "Take this in remembrance of me." I don't remember exactly what happened then. I just remember running all the way up that hill from the fishing hole, shuddering and blood-stained, and the way Duke's face looked that last and final morning, heavy and handsome, blocking out the sun, before he obtained that scar now spearing out white from beneath the hair near his right temple. And I recall thinking I had better leave town before he woke up, and never, ever return, because he surely would kill me. He would surely to God find a way to kill me for whatever it was I had done to him. 17. When Duke leaves Mama's bedroom, when the door closes boom behind his black-suited body, I sink on down to the rose-patterned carpet, and I sit there for some time, while all that electromagnetism settles down around me, sizzling into nothing, the way a coal fire goes to sleep during the night. Wrap my arms around my legs and rest my forehead on my knees, eyes shut tight. I whisper, "Mama? You there?" No answer. No words, nor even the sense of words, inside my head or outside. Just a clean, cool silence. Pressure on my back is gone. Sting on my hand soothes away. The dark, sweet air fills the cracks between my ribs. I untangle my arms and legs and slowly rise, bracing my hands on the gilded edges of the drawer chest. And by the time I've reached my full 5 feet 7 inches of unruly height, the terror has left me entirely, though my every muscle is sapped of strength. I turn to face the mirror, the open box, I grasp it between my fingers and tilt it forward so I can see the contents. And what I find there is not jewels or trinkets or anything a lady might hold dear, but buttons. Big, solid, round, expensive buttons of a masculine type, some gold and some silver and some horn, about a dozen in all, enough to line the bottom of the box and no more. I close the lid and crawl back in my mama's bed and fall straight to sleep. And this time I stay that way, deep and heavy, until hunger wakes me at supper time. 18. Everybody in River Junction goes to Mama's funeral. You'd think she was their patron saint, martyred in some kind of modern auto da fe, the way they weep and carry on. I just stand there in my black dress and black coat and black hat, tall lump of white-faced New York City coal, watching them lower her flower-strewn coffin into the frosted earth. Duke paid a dozen men to dig that hole in the ground, to clear away the snow and pour boiling water on the ground to make it thaw. A big to-do. Church full of hothouse lilies, which were Mama's favorite flower. Thousands and thousands of them hanging in wreaths and stuck in bouquets, such that you almost felt drunk on the scent of them. And now we are standing here in the ancient church cemetery, cold as blue blazes, near to freezing the hair on our behinds, while they pile dirt on Mama's coffin and everybody weeps, except me and Johnny and Patsy, who stands between us clutching our two hands, shocked into stillness. Preacher's preaching something pitiable and comforting. I look up suddenly and gaze across the graveyard to the edge of the trees, where a man stands in a long, dark coat, gazing back. Maybe just at me. Maybe at the whole group of us. Angus's wife sobbing in great theatrical gusts of melancholy. When I lower my head again, I catch the corner of Duke's stare, but I don't acknowledge it. Already given him all the satisfaction he's going to get. 19. The gathering afterward is fixin' to be a long one, and I don't stay above a half hour. Just a glass of milk punch and a neat triangle of a ham sandwich trimmed of its crust. I've got a train to catch, after all. That's what I tell Johnny when he stops me, suitcase in hand in the hallway near the door. "You ought to stay another day," he says. "It ain't respectful leaving in the middle like this. I've already done my morning. Anyway, those old cats will be disappointed to see me stay, don't you think? Can't gossip about me if I'm standing right there in front of them, drinking milk punch and dabbing my eyes. Still," I set down the suitcase. "Say, Johnny boy, I do have a question for you before I go. I was hoping to catch sight of Laura Ann Green here today. You didn't happen to see her about, did you?"
"Laura Ann Green? You mean Ruth Mary's sister out in Hagerstown? She's married now, Geneva Rose. Fellow named Benwick. Had herself a brand new baby couple of weeks ago. She can't come to no funerals."
"No, I mean her mama." Johnny's face goes a little heavy.
"Mrs. Green?"
"That's right."
"Ah, oh, Geneva Rose, poor old Mrs. Green passed on 2 years back. Didn't you know? Some kind of flu it was."
"Passed on?
Awful thing. Near enough broke poor Mama's heart. Like sisters, them two."
"Those two? For the Lord's own sake, Johnny."
"Those two? What kind of business you got with Laura Ann Green?"
"Nothing." I pick up the suitcase. "You keep a good eye on Patsy for me, you hear? You don't let a thing happen to her, not a damn thing." His eyes sit tight on mine. He nods.
"I surely will, Geneva Rose. I can promise you that."
"Good." Rise on tiptoe, kiss his cheek. "Goodbye then, Johnny. You need anything, a place to stay or whatever else, you and Patsy, you come right to me."
"That I will, sis."
He takes my shoulders and squeezes them good.
"The Lord watch over you now. Don't you do nothing stupid back there in the wicked city."
"Would I ever?" He swears a little and kisses my forehead and lets me go. Offers to walk me to the station. I tell him no, he needs to get back to the party. Back to our Patsy. Watch over her innocent wee self, the way the good Lord God tends to his lambs in their pastures. 20. Train's a half hour late, so I'll wait inside the station house, wrapping my hands around a cup of hot, sweet coffee, trying not to cast my eyes toward either the clock or the doorway. Each little noise sets my nerves to jump. Next to my feet sits my old leather satchel, containing my two skirts and blouses and my underthings, which have been washed and pressed by the diligent new laundry maid who now finds employment at the Kelly abode. Also contains Mama's enamel box and the buttons inside it, all wrapped up in tissue. But the laundry maid doesn't know anything about that. It's my little secret. My one small inheritance. Square box half full of buttons. Whistle screams softly through the windows. I set down my coffee on the little table and leave a dime for the station master's wife who served it to me.
Real sorry about your poor mama, Geneva Rose. You fixin' to leave so soon?
An old pot-bellied stove warms the air in the station house, so that when I step through the doors to the new concrete platform, the shock of cold makes my chest tighten, sucks the air tight and safe inside my lungs. I hunker down into my muffler and my coat and stare beneath my lashes at the white clapboard buildings opposite. Kathy's Cafe, the Five and Dime. I'll shut up. Clothes sign propped in the window out of respect for Duke Kelly's dead wife. Whistle screams again, rails sing. Steam engine chugs and sighs and stops in a grand squeal of brakes. A single door flings open at the front of the second car. There are but two altogether. And I grasp the handle of my suitcase and trudge down the platform to meet it. I spare no glance for the sturdy, navy-suited conductor as I bang my way down the aisle to the end of the empty car. Not another soul on board except him and me. And he closes the door and disappears into the first car as soon as I'm up the step. Smells of sour things. Sweat and soiled leather and, God knows, tobacco. Train lurches forward just as I slide into the next-to-last bench on the right, setting my satchel upon the seat between me and the aisle, and I turn my head to the window and watch everything slide away. The new platform and the white clapboard buildings and the neat painted sign that says River Junction. Gaining speed now, past the crossing and the church and the graveyard where Mama lies buried, a clutch of men still hard at work filling that hole. And then the manse, big and square and gabled, grandest house in town until Duke Kelly started making his fortune. Now it's a dollhouse by comparison. Not even the Lord God takes precedence over Duke in River Junction these days. At the front end of the car, the door opens. Conductor appears wearing a cap trimmed in tarnished braid. I open my pocketbook and ready my ticket. His shoulders are burly and his cap pitched low, so I can't see his face. I look away, heart going thud, and stare out the window at the thinning buildings, the gathering white fields. The heavy tread of his feet makes my blood whir. He stops beside me and says, "Ticket, please!" And I look up in surprise because the voice is too high and twangy, not the right voice at all. And now I perceive that his belly is round and his chin pointed, his height too short by a couple of inches. I hand over the ticket. He nicks it and hands it back and treads slowly up the aisle. And when he's gone, I rummage back in my pocketbook until I find the note placed in my hand on the River Junction train platform a week ago. B&O, last carriage, second row from rear, right side. There's no signature. No mark of any kind. Handwriting brusque and sharp in the fine purple-black ink of an expensive fountain pen. I tuck it back inside my pocketbook and lean my head against the seat and close my eyes to the rhythmic clackety-clack of the wheels on the rails, the faint vibrating chug of the engine, the whoosh of my own blood in my ears. Feel as if I'm crushed under the pressure of a massive hand smashing right there into the center of my chest. Ribs creaking and bending, breath thinning, thick fingers curled around my left shoulder with such insistent warmth that I startle upward and realize that I must have fallen asleep. because a man stands next to me, staring down in deep concern from a pair of dark blue eyes.
May I join you, Miss Kelly?
Suit yourself, Tarzan. He moves the satchel to the floor and sits down beside me. I imagine he's going to offer his condolences, the usual platitudes, and I will answer him in kind. But he doesn't speak. Just sits there next to me, one leg crossed over the other, holding a folded newspaper between his two hands at such a still, lifeless angle that I don't believe he's actually reading it. After a while, the heat from his body leaks into mine, and I stare out the window until my eyelids fall and my thoughts soften. The train stops and starts, picking up passengers as it makes its way into Baltimore, and still he doesn't speak. His body is like a barricade holding back the chattering world outside. The train begins its long, staggering approach into Union Station, where I will transfer to the Penzi, carrying me back into the safe embrace of Pennsylvania Station in New York City, my hustle and bustle, my wicked chaos, my Billy Boy. The sun is settling a cloth of lake gold on the dirty rooftops of Baltimore. The electric lamps inside the car flicker and dim. I turn to the man beside me and say, "You've got yourself a deal."
New York City, 1998. Ella had been investigating the municipal bond department at Sterling Bates for 6 days, not including the weekend during which she'd also worked, when she finally ran into Patrick. She was walking into the marble lobby at 8:15 in the morning, towering vanilla latte gripped in her left hand, and he was walking out. They saw each other's amazed faces through the glass of the revolving door. Ella tried to make it to the elevator, but he caught up.
"Ella! Ella, please!"
She turned. "I have to be at work, Patrick."
"Work? Are you kidding me?"
He looked the same. Wasn't that strange? Somehow it didn't make sense that this was the same Patrick she'd known for 6 years. The same square, regular, dependable face and fine brown hair brushed back with the same styling cream. She could see it on the bathroom counter, into the same short corporate silhouette. The same features she'd seen a million times, a million expressions, sharing her home and her life, as recognizably hers as the furniture, the art on the walls. The Patrick she thought she knew, who was in fact an entirely different Patrick, containing a whole segment, like an orange, she thought, that didn't belong to her, and was, in fact, completely unknown to her. So how in God's name did this new Patrick manage to look exactly like the old one? It wasn't fair, because she was trained to love that face, to look on that face always with forgiveness and compassion, to share the burdens on those sharp navy shoulders. That was what she'd vowed, after all, on the beach at Granny's place on Cumberland Island, in front of an unsettlingly mixed crowd of friends and family and strangers. For better or worse. They'd had sex on the very first date. Not because she'd fallen headlong in love over the course of chicken salt amboca and a decent Sangiovese at some red sauce Italian restaurant on the Upper East Side, but because Ella was young and inexperienced, and Patrick had that natural ability to close a deal. She'd met him a week earlier at work, back when Patrick was finishing his analyst gig at J.P. Morgan, and her firm had been called in to sort out a mess. A little flirting led to an invitation for the following Saturday. He was handsome and smart and engaging, wore the invisible coating of a man who was going places. She said yes. After dinner and a long walk, they went to his apartment and discovered a rapport. Some common interests, a shared affinity for numbers and puzzles, started kissing on the sofa. Ella got caught up in the excitement and forgot she was supposed to hold back on a first date. The sex itself was short and unremarkable, which she always regretted. Shouldn't your first sex with your future husband be monumental? Shouldn't you experience every moment, every kiss and touch and lunge with the consciousness that you were having sex with the last person you'd ever have sex with? Wow, that was amazing, Patrick had said, rolling away and shucking off the condom, heading for the bathroom, and Ella lay there and thought, that was quick. But instead of shooing her home, he came back to bed and said, toying with her hair, sizing up her breasts in his palms, "Who knew you were such a hot package, sweet Ella Domerick from Parkinson Peters?" They got to talking, had sex again, and within a couple weeks, they were calling each other boyfriend and girlfriend. And then May arrived, and they were officially in love. The sex got much better, sometimes seriously hot, before it slid inevitably into a certain territory of staleness and routine, reinvigorated occasionally by weekend trips to luxury resorts, but maybe more satisfying for its very predictability. At least, Ella had thought so. Clearly Patrick had not.
"Look," Patrick said earnestly, switching into deal-closing mode. "You can't just ignore this forever. We're married. We have to talk sometime."
"I need time to process this."
"It's been 4 weeks. I don't even know where you're living."
"I'm in the village."
"Ella," he said,
cajoling, lowering his voice to that old, intimate croon of his, looking down at her soulfully.
"Please, just coffee or something. I miss you. Every single minute I miss you. Just seeing your face right now."
Ella's face, right now, was hot and red. She wanted to yell, "Well, maybe you should have thought of that before you stuck your dick inside a prostitute." But she was Ella. Not her mother, not her sister, or her Aunt Viv. Instead, she whispered, "Well, it's been hard for me, too."
"I know. I know. What I did, it was unforgivable. So I'm not asking you to forgive me. Just coffee, okay?"
He glanced around the lobby.
"Not here. Somewhere we can talk."
Ella hiked up the strap of her shoulder bag. "Patrick, I don't know. I don't know if I can talk to you yet. I really don't." He touched her elbow, closed his eyes briefly, like he was praying for guidance, like his feelings were too much for him to bear. Or so Ella had always thought, when Patrick did his closed eyes thing, usually at moments of high emotion, like when she accepted his proposal and when he first told her he loved her. Except now, Ella wondered if he'd really felt anything at all, whether he closed his eyes to disguise instead of reveal. Wasn't there just the slightest whiff of the theatrical about those checked eyeballs? Something studied, the way you might consider how to express an emotion instead of just expressing it.
"Please, Ella," he said. "I swear, it hasn't happened again. It won't happen again. It was a stupid, stupid mistake I will never make again. Therapy, whatever it takes. I will spend the rest of my life making it up to you if you just give me the chance to start over and prove myself. Just coffee."
Ella's mouth froze. She was aware of curious glances, of the way people were stepping carefully around them, like dogs around an invisible fence. Her skin was so flushed, she couldn't think.
"Ella, it's me," he said. "It's Patrick. Remember our honeymoon? That beach on Capri? I want that back. I just want to be your husband again."
Ella stepped back, away from the familiar smell of his clothes. "Fine," she said. "Coffee. Tomorrow afternoon, the Starbucks around the corner on Broad. 3:30.
"Why not today?"
"Because I have a meeting today, Patrick. A very important meeting with the head of the department."
She turned around and made for the elevator bank, drinking down her latte so no one would see that her lips were trembling with the lie she'd just told. As it turned out, she couldn't have made a coffee date that afternoon anyway, or even a meeting with the department head. Right after lunch, her cell phone rang with the news that a pipe had burst in her apartment. Wonderful, she thought. My wonderful life. And yet, that little surge of pleasure that hit her blood at the sight of Hector standing in the middle of her flooded kitchen, wearing the same gray t-shirt as that night she'd first visited his apartment, conferring with the super and somebody in stained clothes who was probably the plumber? Not un-wonderful. Then she noticed the rest of the kitchen. "Oh, my God!" She set her bag on the counter and stared at the water puddling around her heels.
"Wet vac's on its way," said Hector. "I lifted as much stuff as I could onto the tables and counters. The furniture's not looking great, though. The bed's all right. It's high enough up. But the sofa's got a skirt."
Ella didn't really care about the furniture. She'd bought most of it off a showroom floor near the Flatiron, the cheapest she could find. She stared at the bed, which she made tight every morning, sheets and quilt tucked in hospital corners around the mattress, duvet stacked at the foot. Thank God. Imagine the humiliation of an unmade bed at a moment like this.
"But what happened?" she said.
"Pipe burst,"
said the super, in the voice of a man talking to a very stupid female.
"I can see a pipe burst," she said. "But which pipe? Where? How?"
"Under the sink," said Hector. "Some of the plumbing's pretty old, from when the building was first converted from a boarding house into apartments, right after the war. The joint just gave way. Rusted out. Want to see?"
"Not especially."
"The good news is, I can make you a whole new kitchen. Roll up the carpeting and replace any floorboards that couldn't take it. Refinish, good as new."
She looked up at his face, which was obscenely cheerful. "You sound as if you're happy about this."
"Ah, but I've been wanting to get my hands on your kitchen for a while now."
That sounded kind of pervy.
"Only because your mind's in the gutter, as usual."
He turned his head to the door, where a steady banging announced the arrival of the wet vac up several flights of stairs.
"Here we go. Get you dried out in a jiffy."
All right. Yes, she was falling a little in love with Hector, in a totally platonic way. What wasn't to love? He had an adorable dog, he was smart and funny and absolutely brilliantly talented. They had a frisson between them, a pleasant, easy, undemanding frisson. But he hardly so much as touched her because of Claire. Ella had met Claire last weekend, after trudging home from Sterling Bates at 6:30 on a Saturday evening. Claire and Hector had knocked on her door right after she changed into her pajamas and invited her upstairs for pizza and wine and a movie. Ella had inspected those valuable hands and proclaimed them stunning. The rest of her was pretty, too. Petite and curvy, in comparison to Ella's angularity, with a gamine French face like Winona Ryder. And she was clever and funny and charmingly self-deprecating about the hands thing. She held them up to the light and said, "Would you believe I have to insure these things in case they get caught in a car door or something?" Well, they were terrific hands,
long in the fingers, smooth in the skin, delicately curved nails trimmed to a perfect eighth of an inch. No veins popping out anywhere. Yet, Claire sighed. The three of